For nearly two centuries, societies have weighed the merits of free market capitalism and socialism. Debates continue over which system maximizes prosperity and better promotes human flourishing. Free market capitalism decentralizes economic decisions, giving individuals control over what to produce, how much to charge, and what to buy. Their decisions are informed by market prices, which convey important information about scarcity and consumer value. Proponents contend that capitalism delivers the best economic outcomes by giving individuals incentives to create and produce. Critics, on the other hand, point to the persistence of poverty in market economies and rising inequality as proof that capitalism fails to deliver broad-based prosperity. They maintain that this inequality ultimately gives the rich disproportionate economic and political power. In contrast, socialism grants the government the authority to make most economic decisions. The government chooses how to allocate scarce resources based upon what it determines to be most useful to society as a whole. Proponents argue that socialism ensures society's resources are fairly distributed. Critics claim that socialism fails to give people proper economic incentives to innovate and produce, which ultimately reduces economic opportunities for all. Opponents further argue that socialism's powerful central governments become autocratic and threaten political freedom. So which system is better for humanity? For as long as this question has been asked, the debate all too often devolves into name-calling and emotional arguments that fail to advance the discussion. And yet, it is imperative that we keep asking. The Human Prosperity Project at the Hoover Institution seeks to overcome these preconceptions. It employs analysis of free market capitalism and socialism and its many variants to assess how each system affects human flourishing.
Good morning and welcome to the new speaker series of the Hoover Institution called the Human Prosperity Project. I'm Tom Gilligan, director of the Hoover Institution. This speaker series is based on the scholarly research and commentary written by Hoover fellows participating in the Human Prosperity Project on socialism and free market capitalism. The overarching goal of this project is to objectively investigate the historical record to assess the consequences for human welfare, individual liberty, and interactions between nations of various economic systems. The project is research-based with educational and policy-oriented outputs that include long-form essays, short videos, commentary, and this speaker series. This speaker series is just one of the many ways we are able to reach out and share some of the important work coming out of the Hoover Institution. As a reminder, we will be taking audience questions today, and I want to encourage you to submit yours using the Q&A button located at the bottom of your screen. I'm joined today by two esteemed Hoover colleagues, Michael McConnell and John Yu, to discuss liberty, federalism, and the Constitution. Michael is the Richard and Frances Mallory Professor and Director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. From 2002 to the summer of 2009, he served as a circuit judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. Michael has held chaired professorships at the University of Chicago and the University of Utah, and visiting professorships at Harvard University and New York University. John is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Berkeley School of Law, and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. John was an official in the United States Department of Justice and served as general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee under its chairman, Orrin Hatch of Utah. He has a new book out that was released at the end of July entitled Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for the Presidential Power. And he's advertising that book right now. Everybody rush out and buy it. Michael, John, thanks for joining us. I want to move to questions right away if we could. I want to kind of frame a general question and ask you both to address it. The Human Prosperity Project focuses on understanding how different economic and political systems affect well-being. It's about using research and objective analysis to document the outcomes of various systems. Michael, why don't we start with you? Why do you think it's important to do this now in the world, given the way it is today?
So many people think that the U.S. Constitution is just some words on a page. They may have come down from wherever, like the Ten Commandments. But in fact, it's a document with a real theory behind it. It was presented to the American people for actually the very first of the Federalist Papers describes this as being presented to the people for reflection and choice. So it's something to be thought about and understood. It's not just commands. It's actually an entire theory about how a governing system can be set up that maximizes liberty and prosperity and justice.
Yeah. John, the same question to you. Why do you think it's important to be discussing this question today?
I want to thank Hoover, and I want to thank you, Tom, and the leadership of Hoover, because this is a great example of what Hoover does. It gets someone like me and Mike out of our lanes and to think about something that's going on right now, whereas he and I would probably like to sit and think about the year 1787 and 1788 all year if left to our own devices. And I also want to say, it's great to be with Mike, because when I was a young law student, I read an article by a young law professor named Mike McConnell about why federalism was going to make a comeback. And everyone thought that was crazy, but actually I think he turned out to be right. So I'm confessing I steal a lot of my ideas about federalism from Mike McConnell circa 1983. So I think one of the reasons we should be talking about this is because of the headway that socialism is making among young people. So I looked up a poll about this, and it said the Gallup poll just last year found that 43% of Americans thought socialism was a good thing, and 47% of Americans even reported they would vote for a socialist candidate for president. And I think it really involves Hoover's mission, because it's really broken up by age. So amongst baby boomers support capitalism 68-32, and Gen Xers 61-39. But amongst the generation after that, the younger people in school, just graduating from school, socialism has become extremely popular. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing some of that in these elections. So I think it's important that people understand not just what socialism is, but whether it even can map onto our constitutional system of government.
Interesting. Yeah, that raises the next general question. I'll put it to you first, Mike, and ask John to address it too. You both talk about democratic socialism in your papers. Can you both tell me how that fits into our Constitution? Is it compatible with our Constitution? And how does it differ from history's definition of socialism? Mike, could you start?
Well, one of the great advantages of the term democratic socialism to people who use it is that no one really knows quite what it is. Sometimes, as in sort of post-war Britain, it meant that the government, through democratic means, through proper votes in parliament and so forth, began to own and operate the big industries of the country. Mm-hmm. And so that is very much like Marx's idea of socialism, albeit adopted through free democratic elections and representative institutions. It didn't work very well. It turns out the government doesn't run an economy very well. It turns out neither to be more equal nor more efficient, and basically impoverishes everyone except maybe the ruling classes. More recently, there's been a Scandinavian model for democratic socialism, in which you have a capitalist economy. The economy is run by, in much the same way the United States is, in some ways even more free than the economy in the United States, with private enterprise. But then there are relatively high levels of taxation, which are then used for a more generous redistribution program. And so in a sense, this isn't really socialism at all. This is allowing capitalism to be it's the goose with the golden egg. You know, capitalism produces the wealth and the prosperity, and then the government taxes very heavily and redistributes. Even that turned out not to work all that well, because it turns out that very high levels of taxation actually depress economic activity. And so the Scandinavian countries in more recent years have been backing away from that model and adopting policies that are, you know, somewhat more similar to the United States.
Yeah, John.
How does that fit with our Constitution? Yeah. Total government elimination of property and contract would be impossible under our Constitution, because property and contract rights are protected, but high levels of taxation are permitted and high levels of redistribution are permitted. And it is also permitted for the government to own industries. The TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, is really nothing other than a socialist experiment in government-owned electrical utility operation.
Right. Got it. John?
I defer to Mike's view on what socialism is. I think I would complement it by just saying it also requires a very large government, because whether it's the government sort of the 1960s, 1970s variety in the United Kingdom, which is actually trying to run and manage whole sectors of the economy through government ownership of what used to be private industry, or it's even the Scandinavian model, you know, the heavy redistribution, economic and social rights, housing rights, and so on. Both models really depend on having a very large bureaucracy to manage all that, to replace the invisible hand of the market with government decisions. But you know, as Friedrich Hayek wrote in The Road to Serfdom, you also need a really smart bureaucracy, one that's capable of processing enormous amounts of information to make the allocation decisions that the private marketplace used to make. And so that's the other, you know, Mike focuses on the rights that might be intruded upon by socialist government and property, liberty, contract, but also consider the Constitution, I think, has a bias perhaps against having such a large government that has such broad-ranging powers that it could replace the millions of decisions made every day by producers and consumers.
Yeah, interesting. Michael, I want to shift back to you to talk more about the Constitution. The Constitution is written to protect life, liberty, and people's property. How does it also establish a foundation for long-lasting national prosperity? You mentioned the protection of the rights to contract and the sanctity of property. Are there other things that are designed to kind of increase national prosperity?
Well, there certainly are, but I don't want to pass by too quickly the idea of protecting life, liberty, and property. That's the Due Process Clause. And what it says is that no person may be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. And what does law mean? It means enacted legislation by representatives of the people, enforced through traditional and fair practices. That slows things down. It means that the government can't just willy-nilly, you know, go around and confiscate property or arbitrarily tell people what they need to do. There have to be generally applicable laws enforced in a general way. That gives security so that we are able to organize our lives, invest in enterprises, and have confidence that what we are doing is not going to be taken away tomorrow. And it doesn't mean we have absolute security, but it gives a significant degree of security. Now, in addition to that, something that the framers cared a lot about, but we don't actually talk about very much, is that they did also set up an infrastructure for what they called a commercial republic. Now, this was quite controversial. There were those who did not want a commercial republic. Agrarian Republicans like Thomas Jefferson and many Southerners, especially the slave-owning portion of the country, did not oppose having a commercial republic, because a commercial republic is just philosophically inconsistent with the kind of plantation-based, bound labor-based economy of the South. But they did not win most of those battles at Philadelphia in 1787. We have elaborate, I mean, simply stated, but the basis for an elaborate system of government to support what would become a modern commercial republic, that would encourage trade, that would allow for ways in which disputes between companies and contract disputes, especially in property disputes, could be fairly resolved without local juries playing favorites. Alexander Hamilton was able to come in as the first Secretary of the Treasury and set up a whole series of institutions under the a new government that would support a prosperous, modern, from their point of view, economy. Adam Smith had just written The Wealth of Nations in 1776. Hamilton read it in detail, and he was bringing the best insights of cutting edge economics into setting up this new government.
Yeah. John, let me ask you another question. And this is based on, you cited some survey data on popularity of democratic socialism amongst American population. William Goetz asked the following question: Americans seem to value individualism over collectivism. Would the younger generation be willing to give up some of their individual rights to gain the benefits of socialism?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I guess I can answer it in part by turning back to some of the data and saying it seems like the millennial generation are confused about socialism. So I think they kind of associate capitalism with protection of big business, which is not what me and Mike are talking about at all. So if you look at the data, it says 83% of millennials tell pollsters that they have a positive view of quote unquote free enterprise. But then they like, a majority of them also like socialism. Yeah. And a majority dislike big business. So I don't think they're really aware of the questions, trade-offs, perhaps, between individual liberty and more collective ownership. It sounds to me like, as with many things of the students we have in school these days, they think they're going to just have more of everything, right? Individual rights plus entrepreneurship plus, a healthy growing economy. But I suspect if you look at that data and they really had to face the kind of trade-offs that adults often think about,
right,
I kind of believe they would rather have the individual liberty rather than the socialism. They just need to, live a little longer and experience what it's like to draw a paycheck and ask, who is this FICA guy who keeps taking 14% of my paycheck out of here?
Yeah. John, let me switch the discussion a little bit. A lot of the way our economic and social system in the United States, it's evolved into one of federalism, where authority for different decision makings is allocated to different levels of government. What are the advantages and disadvantages of federalism for effective government?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think federalism has a lot of the benefits which we might just associate with decentralization of government power. Although some aspects of it, I think, are particularly American. There's the famous one, the quote-unquote laboratories of democracy, where if we don't know the answer to a social problem, like for example with COVID right now or disorder in the cities, different states can try out different policy solutions and the rest of the country isn't at risk. We can see what works and then more states can adopt them. It's almost like a free market for policy solutions. There's also the idea that our country is so diverse and large that having federalism allows local governments to tailor and adapt general policy goals to the unique circumstances of where they are. If you're in Utah, for example, you may not have to worry so much about social distancing and the pandemic as you would if you're in California. Right. And then there's the idea, I think is more a modern idea, that it's actually good for states to compete, that it produces efficiency, that if states compete with each other, they offer all of us packages of tax rates and public policies, and people can decide when they move which policies they like.
Yeah.
And I think that has a healthy effect on the states and provide competition and tax rates, competition and making their governments more efficient, but also gives us as citizens the ability to choose our preferences amongst the states. People here in California, I don't know why, but maybe they just like having high taxes, but perhaps they also like the big university system and the protections for the environment that might be the cost of having high taxes. And then the last one, this is more maybe a more modern idea, I'm curious what you guys think about it, is maybe federalism is also risk averse. It's almost built, and this I think is consonant with the framers, in that they didn't necessarily think highly of human nature. They might have thought people tend to make mistakes. They didn't have a great trust in, right? If you were in China, you thought that the government will come up with solutions, the right solutions to public policy problems. Why would you have a decentralized government? It would only slow down and impede your ability to implement the right answer. Right. But if you're not sure what the right answer is, then maybe you would decentralize government power because you don't want the country to make a terrible mistake by acting rashly either.
I see. Interesting. So in some sense, the framers created the federal system as a safeguard against mistakes and as a way to propagate new ideas and be innovative in public policy, if you will. If you're just joining us, I'm Tom Gilligan, and this is the Hoover Institution's Human Prosperity Project speaker series with Michael McConnell and John Yu. We have an interesting question. I'll throw it out to both of you. Michael Kelly says, I just reread the Federalist Papers again. I was stunned to realize that they were written to prevent just what is happening today. I welcome your comments. What do you think, Michael?
Well, they were written to advocate for a new system that we still have to a very great extent today. But one of the main theories in the Federalist Papers is that through decentralization of power, both through federalism and also through separation of powers between the various branches, that we avoid the dangers both of tyranny on the one hand, but also of madness, if you would. That is the conflagration, as Madison puts it, of ideas, that a really bad idea might become super popular in one place, but it's not going to be adopted nationwide. It's not like the French Revolution, where everything is happening within a few arrondissements in Paris, and then when they do things, it's like that's it. Instead, you have to win in New York, but you also have to win in Arizona, and those are very different places. And so it requires more persuasion, and it gives time for people to think a second time about a particular developments. Like, a possible example, this may be controversial, but some people say defund the police.
Right.
And there are some cities that are at least acting in a small way in that direction. We'll have time to find out whether people's lives are better in the places that cut the police force. I have my doubts, but whether they're right or they're wrong, we'll find out before we have it as a national policy.
Interesting. Doug Schrivener asked the following question. John, I'll let you take a crack at it. Many critics of our country's response to COVID-19 pandemic have said that we lack a national plan and national actions and blame federalism for part of that. Can our system respond effectively to a national crisis like a pandemic, climate change, and the like? Is the old model able to respond to modern challenges?
I think so. What you could just look at it comparatively. I think Neil Ferguson actually made this point in his earlier paper. If you look at what's happened in Europe, which has strongly centralized governments, they don't have the greatest track record over the last 100 years in responding to crises and emergencies. Actually, Neil made a provocative point. I didn't count it up, but he said the thing that has killed the most people in the last 100 years has been socialist and communist government, not famine, not war. The alternative of having a very centralized government that might make terrible mistakes, right, is the other polar opposite to what we're talking about, a decentralized government. But and this also ties in with the past question from Michael about the Federalist Papers, is it's interesting, the Federalist Papers were not advocating for a completely decentralized government. They had that under the Articles of Confederation, and that had not worked. So they're, as Mike was saying, they're arguing for some kind of mixture or a hybrid that's between complete decentralization and the kind of absolutist centralized governments in Europe that existed even in the 18th a century. And so when it comes to a pandemic or civil disorder, the balance they struck was public health and safety would be the primary responsibility of state and local governments, of governors and mayors, but that the national government had a role. The national has the ability to, you know, make grants to states, as we've been doing at the tune of trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
The federal government can provide resources, equipment, you know, personal protective equipment, and so on, expertise, you know, it's funding the vaccine, funding research, providing science. And I think that's basically the general framework for our Constitution, is that, yes, states go first because we are a little bit risk averse, but the federal government has strong tools to provide incentives to get the states to follow federal guidelines. But I completely agree with the question. We don't have the ability, I think, of China or, you know, the United Kingdom because of the fear, I think, this kind of risk aversion to making public policy that you pointed out, Tom.
Okay, got it. John, okay, let me
just jump in.
Yeah, please, Michael.
Can I jump in here for a second? You know, I have no confidence in any predictions about the coronavirus and what's going to happen and what we'll think in 6 months or 50 years about this, but my reaction to the question as of right now is the questioner's right, but it's a good thing, not a bad thing, that I do think that our Constitution and our system makes it hard to have a fully national response to coronavirus. I don't think we should have a fully national response. There's some things that the national government does much better than the states, but this virus seems to, it's different in different places. So in a city like New York, where you have dependency on the subways and much more, it's a very requires a very different set of policies than for a state like, say, Nevada, where, you know, it's entirely different, although the casinos in Las Vegas are yet another issue. And we also just don't know. There are legitimate differences of opinion about things like opening up the schools for mm-hmm. elementary and secondary education. Why decide that on a national basis when we can let each community work it out in light of their own circumstances, but doing different things, and we'll get a little bit of experience from that. I do not have enough confidence in Donald Trump to want him to be running the entire coronavirus reaction for the entire country. I'm really happier to have governors of and mayors of different persuasions doing their own thing.
Can I throw in one other thing? It's just that also ties into one other reason for decentralization I didn't mention, which was government closer to the people is going to be more accountable and more responsive to the electorate than Washington, D.C. So Michael's right, not only will you have different policies for different geographic regions, but we also have the ability as individual citizens to affect and hold those governors and mayors accountable faster than we could Washington.
Yeah. Let me go back to our original topic in socialism, and I'll ask you both this, and Michael, you can start. Does our Constitution or federalism deter a socialist form of government at the federal level, at the state level, at the local level? If you look locally around our nation, you see municipal utilities, which of course are owned by governments or people. What does our Constitution or federalism permit with respect to the socialist form of economic organization?
So there's no simple yes or no to this. Part of it has to do with what do we mean by socialism? Because, you know, sort of full bore, you know, Marxist-style socialism would be quite contrary to the Constitution in any number of ways. You think of freedom of speech and freedom of religion and regular elections. None of those things exist in a full-on Marxist socialist system. Now, various forms of soft socialism, I think, are not inconsistent. They are permissible under the Constitution. I do think there's some things about our Constitution that sort of point, that encourage a more a more free enterprise approach, a more decentralized approach. Among them, again, is this sense of competition among the states. You know, socialism is really monopoly. If you don't like big business and monopoly, the very last thing you should want is government ownership, because it is the most intransigent monopoly system of all, and it can protect itself against competition. So when we have a system set up that has competition built in as part of its DNA, it's just, it's going to be less likely that we're going to move in a socialist direction. Lots of small businesses, lots of economic activity directed by you know, individual people, rather than top-down, you know, bureaucratic systems which is what socialism calls for.
John, you have a response to that. Does our Constitution or federalism block a full-scale national socialistic form of economic organization?
I think so. You know, scholars have been arguing about this for 100 years. So around 1905, there was a German sociologist who wrote an article saying, why is there no socialism in America? Now, being a German sociologist, he meant that with a tone of disappointment, whereas an American would say, yeah, that's great. And so there, people have been trying to figure out, it's another species of this issue, why is America so exceptional, a nation that it has resisted this kind of political movement, which has run the governments of many of our peer countries at some point in the last 100 years? And so when you look at it, people talk about, it's a lot of people thought maybe it is the Constitution that is something that is so different than these other countries. The Constitution is so hard to change. It is so permanent in a way. It's something a lot of Americans, since we're all from other parts of the world, that is our primary allegiance, is to the Constitution and national system of government. And it is decentralized. And also, as Michael's emphasizing, it has a protection for natural rights. So there is built into the document, it's reinforced after the Civil War, this idea that each person has a natural right to life, liberty, and property that are not to be defined by the state. And it does reject, at least so far, the idea that there are positive rights, and the government owes you housing and education and a certain income. And so that does seem to me, at least, to, plus the decentralization does seem to be a strong deterrent against the kind of, you know, modern socialism, the idea of positive rights and, you know, large redistribution of income, you know, the lack of private property rights upon, I think, which a socialist system would depend.
Yeah, got it. Here's a question from Bob Sheridan. Our upcoming election will test our federal system in a unique and possibly frightening way. What is your outlook? Is there a reason for optimism?
I'm not hugely optimistic in the short run. I do think that our institutions are very strong, and that we will come through this. I don't want to be overly political, but I think that both of our political parties have become somewhat captured by elements within them that are devoted to not cooperating, that are not very interested in actually finding solutions to our problems, but seem more interested in, you know, spitting at each other and insulting one another. And in my lifetime, there have been some elections where I say, well, actually, you know, either candidate would be fine for the country, and there are others where it seems like there's no particularly good choice. And at least from my point of view, that's where we are.
Can I make a point just of the running of elections, which is this is another area where the Constitution adopts this federal decentralized approach. The states under the Constitution are the people who run elections, governors and mayors, election board. Most states drive the decision down to the county level. The federal government can intervene as to the time, place, and manner, if Congress wants to use that power, to set nationwide rules, but generally they don't. And again, so it has that same features to it that with the socialism and federalism we're talking about before. If you were worried that the Russians or the Chinese were going to hack into our electoral systems, would you rather there be one national election system or 3,000 or 4,000 different county electoral boards, each running their own little elections? One of the things in about 2016 and whether it was possible for the Russians or Chinese to actually hack into our vote counting systems is they would have had to hack into 3,000 or 4,000 different independent systems for counting votes. That gives, again, it gives the system a certain kind of a resiliency from attack that maybe you wouldn't have if you had just one gigantic national computerized voting system.
Yeah. Here's another question, which is very similar, but I think it's a tougher question. And I want to give it to you guys. It's from Chantel Miles. It says, of federalism, it can be said that the whole is more than the sum of its parts. But what happens if the parts have a bias? In this case, a Republican or Democratic or partisan bias. And how does the system calibrate so federalism enjoys its benefits that it was created for when you have these kind of this very aggressive form of competition that tries to not work with but destroy the other parts of the federal decision-making process?
Well, I don't think the system as a whole has a partisan bias one way or the other. I think we're a very divided country with, there are more Republican-dominated states, but the bigger states tend to be Democratic-dominated, not all of them, what I think we're experiencing right now that is historically unusual, at least from the last, post-World War I, is the extreme degree of partisan polarization that we see. So red states are very different from blue states, and Republican congressmen don't work very well with Democratic congressmen and vice versa. The parties seem to lack a center, and within each party, each party seems to be extremely responsive to its extreme rather than toward. I mean, it used to be that standard political science taught that a two-party system led to the median voter hypothesis, and that does not seem to be working much anymore. I think that's a difference, but I don't think that's federalism. I think that's due to a lot of other things, including social media, including the way campaigns are financed, and cultural change too, which we can't overlook.
Yeah, I love this question because it recalls what the founders were really wrestling in they were wrestling in a very terrible, humid summer in my hometown of Philadelphia. I didn't envy them that. But what they were wrestling about was how to design a republic that actually would be somewhat immune to a kind of partisan bias that Chantal's asking about. And this is really addressed, I love this, because it's really addressed by Madison in Federalist Number 10. Mm-hmm. He was responding to Montesquieu's idea that democracy could only work in a city-state. And with Madison, he flipped this on its head in a really remarkable way. And he said, look, but the problem with having a small democracy is that it's easily taken over by a party. That, what Madison, I think, would say back to Chantal would be, if you're really worried about partisan bias, would you want there to be one government or many governments? Because you might be on the losing end if your opponent takes over the only power in the country. And so Madison's answer was, actually, democracy will work better in the conditions opposite to Montesquieu's view, that if a big, large republic like ours, which is large geographically and in population, that will be better for democracy because then no one party is going to take over all the levers of government. Instead, the only things he thought that would get through the government would be things on which there was a high level of agreement and consensus. And his hope was that would represent more the common good rather than one political party taking over.
Yeah. about it. I have a few questions that gets back to this notion that younger people find socialism appealing. Here's a question from Nick Tredinick. Here's this question. It seems that education is undermining an appreciation of federalism and the Constitution. Is there a way to displace Zinn-like textbooks, this is Howard Zinn-like textbooks, with something more appreciative of the underlying principles of our Constitution? Michael, I'll let you take that one up first.
The question is who's paying attention? And I think that there's been a very organized and very successful movement at local school board levels to introduce curricula that are of the Zen-like character. Everybody else has been kind of asleep at the switch. And that isn't built into the cake in any way. That's just the way things have been working. And the solution to that is that there needs to be a revitalization, probably on the part of parents, interest in having public schools teach actual civics, actual American history, in a balanced way. I don't want it to be like sugar-coated or Disney-fied, but we have a lot to be proud of with the United States. And you know, even the critiques of the United States having to do with racial justice and other issues arise from the commitments of the United States. You know, the idea of the importance of racial justice did not come out of nowhere. It came right smack out of the American tradition. And, you know, I think that's been lost to a very great extent. And education is a place, the classroom is the place to confront this.
Interesting. John?
I think the answer has to come from the same principles that we're talking about here, decentralization and competition. I agree with Mike, there does seem, you know, the educational system itself is a monopoly of government. And so it seems to me if that monopoly is producing a product that is ineffective and it's not preparing students for their roles as citizens and as successful adults, then let's have more competition. Tom Sowell has a wonderful new book out about charter schools. Mm-hmm. That's just a form of competition against this monopoly. I think what we're doing now today, you know, having forums and lectures through Zoom, and so we can reach larger numbers of people than just who shows up in a classroom, is another form of that. Things like the Khan Academy, where you have videotaped lectures on introductory mm-hmm. subjects, is another example. So I think the way to defeat it is not necessarily just writing an alternative book. There are alternative course books and materials to use, but this is where I think Hoover Research is doing a good job, is trying to think of alternative channels or structures that will provide competitive pressure to the monopoly of locally controlled schools. And that's got to be, I think, internet-based systems like this.
Yeah, just to carry on, and maybe a final question for us to end with, what do you think are the most constructive ways to diffuse, you know, as one might put it, the siren song of socialism among young people? How do we better educate or inform the young about the kind of economic opportunities that socialist systems tend to historically have provided people? Michael?
So I think we need to understand what young people are saying and thinking, and then talk to them about how actually to achieve it. Because, you know, I think that there's just a lot of misunderstanding out there. And, you know, there's a kind of a view that you can have all the benefits of, you know, modern commercial capitalism and trash it at the same time. You can't. They're trade-offs. And so to talk seriously with young people about what they want, but then to help them understand how to get there would be much better. I think there's a certain tendency of people of our age maybe just to sort of scoff at the fact that young people don't remember the disaster of the Soviet Union, and they don't, they don't remember all these things that they weren't around, right? They don't know that how terrible things have been in Castro's Cuba. They, for some reason, they're not looking at Venezuela. They don't, and but rather than scoff, I think we need to take what they're saying seriously, and but then help them to reason how to productively and constructively get to the kind of society that they want.
Yeah. John, final word?
I'm too tempted to say to the adults who are watching, the best way to get their kids to understand the benefits of capitalism is just kick them out of your basement and make them get a job. When they pull their first paycheck and they see all the withholding taxes, they'll come to understand the virtues of capitalism. Sometimes I think we are so, and this builds on other part things that Hoover is working on, but sometimes we get so focused on America that we ignore the rest of the world. And, I'm an immigrant to the United States. And when you look at the track record of socialism and communism in the rest of the world, I don't think it's even that close. You look at why do tens of millions of people want to emigrate to the United States and gladly change places with anybody here in the country? It's because this non-socialist system actually has a great track record of success. Despite all the problems we've had in our history, I think it is, the United States still has done a very, very good job. And I would put its track record up against any of these countries that have had socialism or communism in the past. And I don't think it's a close question.
Yeah, amazing. Great. Michael, John, thanks so much for your time this morning and for sharing your thoughts on such an important topic. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
The next session in the Human Prosperity Project speaker series will take place on Thursday, August 20th at 11 a.m. Pacific time, and will feature Hoover Fellows Eddie Lazier and Leo Hanian to discuss opportunity and income inequality. On September 3rd, we will take a look at socialism and capitalism through the lens of two well-known historians, Neil Ferguson and Victor Davis Hanson. And on September 17th, Hoover Fellows Terry Anderson and Steve Habro will discuss property rights, innovation, and prosperity. You can find the Hoover Institution and more information on the Human Prosperity Project online at our website, hoover.org. Again, thank you for joining us today, and have a great weekend.